Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. Jeff Perkins. He specializes in internal and preventative medicine, including holistic care, in the Capital Region. He's generally known as the doctor's doctor. Dr. Perkins earned his medical degree from the Des Moines University of Osteopathic Medicine and Surgery. He completed his residency at Albany Med and at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. Jeff Perkins, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you, Alan. A pleasure to be here.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take all comers. Jeff, testosterone. Tell me a little about that.
Very important hormone. Very important hormone. That's important to both men and women, actually.
Really?
Yes. And most of us, you know, there's a great deal of advertising on television about replacing testosterone in men. And unfortunately, testosterone is being used too liberally in many male populations. However, very little public information is given, and the public forgets that women have testosterone as well. Right. And when their testosterone levels drop, which usually occurs around menopause and after menopause, some women can not feel well because of it. And it's more than just being tired and so forth, is they actually very much lose their libido and sexual desire. And one of the things that affects both men and women with low testosterone is declining bone mass, is osteoporosis. And so as a practicing internist, you know, I try to diagnose my men who were at risk for low testosterone, and occasionally women who, you know, in conversation we find out that they've lost their desire. It just went away. They don't understand it anymore. And it's physically uncomfortable for them to have relations. And sometimes a very little bit of testosterone applied topically to the skin, formulated by a compounding pharmacy, you know, can be helpful. But of course, there are potential side effects in treating men and women with testosterone.
So can you do it? You find out by a blood test?
Yeah. Generally, you find out first by history. Okay. So generally, the history that we'll say men initially, we'll talk about men. Men will complain of being fatigued, losing their muscle strength, being tired. They experience erectile dysfunction, sexual dysfunction. They start to lose their libido, and they find they have trouble losing weight. And there's a relationship between low testosterone and actually affecting sleep adversely, sleep apnea, and which is important in treating it as well. So blood tests are done, and they're usually done in the early morning between 8 and 10, because that's when testosterone production is usually the highest. And a number of hormonal blood tests are ultimately done, and you can't just make a diagnosis on one test. And you can never make a diagnosis without the test. You know, there are plenty of men, older men, who have many of those symptoms that have nothing to do with testosterone. And to treat them empirically, so to speak, without adequate diagnostics is, I think, bad medicine. Mm-hmm. So a series of blood tests, I usually get three different blood tests about a week or two apart in men, all done between 8 and 10 in the morning. And if the tests come back in the very low range, then I do further testing, because the question has to be answered as to why. Why is the testosterone low? Is it just aging, like a woman goes through menopause and the ovaries age out? Is it that the testicles are aging out? Or is there an underlying condition, like a pituitary disorder, diabetes, an iron storage disorder, and so forth? And all these things have to be looked at with subsequent testing. I've had several men with low testosterone who actually had pituitary tumors. Yeah. And it was their low testosterone which was the tip-off point to investigate the pituitary.
Okay, we'll take a first call. Thank you, Jeff. And I want to remind everybody, it was Jeff Perkins who brought us those marvelous CDs and which he created just for WAMC on vitamin D. And boy, have you turned out to be right about vitamin D.
I think so.
Yeah. Let's go to Catherine of Fishkill. Okay, Catherine, you're on.
Hi, Alan.
Hey.
I'm a patient of Dan Cameron's, who you know. I have Lyme disease, and I'm wondering if you know of any successful homeopathic treatments for Lyme?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't help you there. I really do not practice homeopathy. I have no expertise in it. So I really can't offer you or tell you of any successful treatments because I simply don't have that knowledge.
Well, Catherine, there's nothing better than an honest man, right?
That's true. Absolutely.
Thank you, Catherine. Appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
Right, let's go to Ian in Claverack. Okay, Ian, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know the doctor's opinion of a vegan diet as a preventative medicine.
Yeah, I think that's a great question because certainly veganism is making a comeback again. And I think for some people who want to eat this way, you know, not having any products that are derived from animals, either directly or indirectly, such as milk, eggs, and so forth. As long as it's extremely well balanced with plenty of plant protein from beans and nuts, and it's generally going to be lower in fat. If you're avoiding saturated fats like cheese and butter and so forth, if you like being a vegan. If the food's properly prepared, my wife, for example, made a fantastic, it was a vegan diet. There was no meat products or animal products derived indirectly or directly last night. It was kale and spinach and beans and olive oil and garlic, all stir-fried over wild rice. I mean, it was wonderful. It was very tasty and a pleasurable experience.
Ian, why do you ask?
Well, I am a vegan myself, and there is a quite a famous vegan doctor in our neighborhood here, Dr. Esselstyn.
Right.
And I attended in September a conference where about 500 people from all over the country came, and I was very impressed with the medical benefits that were touted by these speakers.
Okay. Hey, Ian, thank you for the wonderful call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Jeff Perkins, we only have a minute on this thing, but we're finding more and more things about this vitamin D, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I, as you know, we spoke about vitamin D a few years ago.
Yeah.
And vitamin D, there's a lot of controversy about, you know, who should take vitamin D and who shouldn't take vitamin D and who should be tested. I can tell you that unless you're somebody that gets a lot of sunlight up here, you know, on your arms and legs over the summertime from like May through early September, you are very likely to be vitamin D deficient.
Because of where we live.
Yeah, because we're at this latitude, you know, at 42 degrees latitude north, there's only a few months that you can make vitamin D. Now, vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So the purpose of making it is to kind of keep you going through most of the winter. You make enough of it. A half an hour of sunlight between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. with your arms and legs exposed can actually give you between 5 and 10,000 units of vitamin D. Okay, which is enough to last you for many days.
How much do you take?
I take about 2,000 units a day.
I take 5.
Yes. I think, recommended that.
Yes, you. Thank you. Thanks a lot for that. Thanks a lot for that.
Yeah.
Jeff, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. There's plenty of free phones. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMZ comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shops. Professional picture framing and fine art materials. Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Barry Price Architecture. Since 1996, specializing in buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics. BarryPriceArchitecture.com.
And we are back with Dr. Jeff Perkins. All five phones are ringing. When somebody hangs up, it's your turn. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Ellie in Hurley. Okay, is it L in Hurley?
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, I have a question about SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth.
Go ahead.
And I was curious about the effectiveness of the antibiotic Reflaxin and the side effects, as well as the cause and other natural treatments.
Okay. Well, I'll answer that as best as I can, and I will tell you I probably cannot give you a complete answer, but one that will at least maybe get you started and down the right path to solve this issue. Number one, it's normal for us to all have bacteria in our GI tracts. I mean, they occur in the lower esophagus all the way down to the anus. And the bacteria, ideally healthy bacteria, should be there because they really help us. Bacteria are in essence, a large organism that help make certain vitamins. They make vitamin K, okay? They help our immune systems work properly. And however, there needs to be the right kind of bacteria in the GI tract as the dominant form of bacteria. And sometimes when we take regular antibiotics for a long period of time, we can mess up that balance of it's called the microbiotic flora, and we kill off too many of the good bacteria. When, for example, I have patients take a long-term antibiotic for a severe lung infection or for Lyme disease or something of this sort, I have them take probiotic capsules to try to keep up the bacterial content during the course of antibiotics and for weeks afterwards, if not indefinitely, to take a small dose. And we can get beneficial bacteria from certain fermented foods, not necessarily capsules. Obviously, yogurt and kefir, kimchi, miso soup, sauerkraut, pickles all have healthy bacteria in the fermentation process, which are good for us. Now, as far as the antibiotic like Rifaxam and so forth, these drugs are designed for short-term use. That type of Zyfaxam and its sister drug, Rifaxam, they're very expensive.
Yeah, it's right.
You know, yeah. And they're very expensive. They're really not designed to be used for weeks and weeks. We're just talking often for just a few days to maybe 10 days or so to help get rid of excessive bacterial overgrowth. As far as causes are concerned, there are some people, for example, who have pouches in their intestine, the large colon, diverticular disease, very common. And sometimes bacteria can grow in there. There are certain inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis where abnormal bacteria can grow in there. I think the best way of approaching it is really with a very healthy, well-balanced diet that has, again, fermented foods. In it, as we discussed, yogurt, if possible, kefir. I love kefir. It's a great source. I've had several patients with...
What is it?
Kefir is a fermented yogurt milk of Middle Eastern origin.
Okay.
I've had several patients who have been diagnosed with severe irritable bowel syndrome and very, very symptomatic. And I put them on 4 ounces of kefir twice a day, and their symptoms have gone away. With
even
having
if you're lactose intolerant?
Well, generally, it's a good question. Most people can tolerate yogurt because the bacteria breaks down the lactose and milk sugars. Okay, so and if you have severe lactose intolerance and can't tolerate it, you can get drops of lactate enzyme or take lactate tablets before drinking it to help break down the milk sugars if you're severely intolerant. But the answer is most people, again, can tolerate kefir and yogurt.
Well, Elle, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to John in Kingston. John in Kingston, you're on.
Thank you, Dr. Shartok, Dr. Perkins. See if I can be brief. I'm wondering what the doctor's thoughts are on the pharmaceuticals coming into doctor's offices with their display of things that translate into the prescription pad from the doctor as it applies to the individual, and the accountability and responsibility about the physiology of the human that's being dosed, and what kind of outcome are we looking for when there's a, we have a lot of different prescriptions to that person that they have to take during the day?
Well, you've asked three questions, and I'm going to focus on the first one primarily. Without a doubt, the pharmaceutical industry is a multi-million dollar industry that does its best to influence doctors' prescribing habits. Years ago, they used to directly influence doctors' prescribing habits by inviting them to conferences and trips, and they would pay for everything, even to bring the doctor's family along. And I have to admit, I've gone to, years ago, you know, one or two of those conferences where I thought it would be educational. They're not allowed to do that anymore. At the most, they bring in an inexpensive lunch and some candy and that sort of thing. But I think doctors have to be very aware that the pharmaceutical representative, as part of their industry, their job is to try to influence you to write for their drug. That's how the company makes money, and that's how, in part, the representative makes money, the pharmaceutical rep. Personally, my philosophy is I tend to be very conservative with prescribing new brand name drugs unless I think it's the best option available for the patient. Because number one, most of the time it hasn't been around long enough. I've been practicing medicine now for over 40 years, and I've seen so many wonderfully touted drugs by Big Pharma come into the office and marketed and advertised and so forth. And 2 years later, they're pulled from the drugstore shelves because they shut down people's liver or kidneys. So I'm not one to jump usually on the new drug bandwagon. I think there are plenty less expensive generic drugs that people can take for their conditions. But that brings up another issue with generic drugs. Many of them are becoming expensive. And they're becoming expensive because large pharmaceutical manufacturers have bought the generic companies.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay, so all of a sudden, these prices are going up. A similar example is what happened with the drug colchicine to treat gout and familial Mediterranean fever. Colchicine is an ancient plant-based medicine that's been around for over 2,000 years. Doctors have known about it. And it used to be, up till a few years ago, very inexpensive. It was like a couple pennies a day to take 0.6 milligrams of colchicine for a gouty attack. The FDA allowed a drug company to do research on the drug because it was a grandfather drug and not one that was subject to what was considered proper scientific research. And because this company did some research and they found some modifications in how to use the drug, they were able to patent colchicine under their brand name. And now a drug that was literally 5 cents a day becomes $5 a day. It's the same medicine. So, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has an important place in our society. They make new drugs. That's important. But I think doctors have to be aware that that there is a strong, strong attempt to influence them to prescribe the branded most expensive drugs. And usually there are less expensive alternatives that work just as well available.
That's great. Hey, John, thanks for that. Great question. You got a great answer. Appreciate it.
Thank you both.
Right.
Welcome.
Chuck in Ankrum. Chuck.
Hi to both of you.
Hello.
I'm calling with a question about CoQ10 and whether you recommend it and what dosage for people who are on stat drugs.
Yeah, it's a great question, Chuck. I actually do recommend CoQ10. I have for years and years and years in people who are taking statin drugs particularly. And here's why. Statin drugs block the synthesis of cholesterol. But the first thing they drop in that they block in the precursor molecule that starts to make cholesterol is the formation of this substance called ubiquinone, popularly known as CoQ10. And it's about 6 or 7 steps later that cholesterol is made. Well, ubiquinone is necessary for cells, heart muscle cells, regular muscle cells, to utilize oxygen and phosphates to make energy. And statins, by blocking the formation of ubiquinone, can cause sometimes, not every, there's many people who take a statin, have no symptoms whatsoever. They feel fine. But for those in particular who start getting muscle aches, they have muscle fatigue on a statin, sometimes stopping the statin and restarting it with CoQ10 can make a big difference. At the same time. Or people who tend to have muscle aches to begin with, like fibromyalgia and so forth. Okay. If those people have to take a statin, I have them take CoQ10 at the same time. And the dosage I use starts at about 100 milligrams. Generally, 200 milligrams is what one needs. There's another issue, though, is what type of statin? Because there's two classes of statins. There's fat-soluble statins and water-soluble statins. The fat-soluble statins, primarily Lipitor and Zocor, okay, in my experience, have a higher incidence of causing muscle aches and pains than the water-soluble statins, like Pravastatin, for example, which is generic and inexpensive. Crestor also is a water-soluble statin, but it's branded, you know, and much more expensive.
Chuck, thank you very much.
I just want to follow up with the real question, which is without any symptomatic problems, do you still recommend it?
Yeah.
You know, prophylactic. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. And often I do. There's only one downside to taking CoQ10. Okay, and that is if you have to take vitamin K. If you're taking if you're taking warfarin or Coumadin, because. Yep. The molecule ubiquinone is, in essence, like a first cousin of vitamin K, which is menaquinone. And they're very similar molecularly. So CoQ10 can actually interfere with warfarin and make your blood too thick, which if you have an artificial valve, you know, or have had a stroke or you have atrial fibrillation and you're taking warfarin, you probably do not want to take coenzyme Q10.
Okay, Chuck, thanks a lot.
Appreciate Thank you both.
Yeah. Let's go to Maria in Olive Bridge. Okay.
Hi. Wow. You've said so many things that I have questions about, but I originally called to ask about vitamin D. I only tuned in a bit before that discussion, so forgive me if I'm asking something you've already answered, but what about the possible negative side effects of vitamin D? I mean, does it, especially on the gastrointestinal system, does it, for instance, produce have the tendency to produce gas or, the simple question. Yeah.
Okay. Well, certainly, although there are, I think, reasonable and significant benefits to taking a proper dose of vitamin D, there are side effects like of taking too much of anything. You can drink too much water and have side effects and problems.
Right.
However, vitamin D has, you know, very high tolerance before it starts causing problems with patients. Generally, the upper limit of normal per day would be 10,000 units in rare cases where someone has extreme vitamin D deficiency for various reasons. But if a patient stays under 10,000 units, unless they have certain underlying conditions, they're likely to have no problem and no toxicity. However, if one is taking a higher dose of vitamin D around that 10,000 unit range, you need to have your vitamin D level measured. Now, a healthy vitamin D level, the government would say, is 20. I disagree with that. When you look at the data very, very carefully, a healthy vitamin D level seems to be between 40 and 60, 65 or so. That's where I try to keep my patients. The form of vitamin D is very important because vitamin D, being a fat-soluble product, has to be ideally made with oil. So like a vitamin D gel capsule or an oily drops are the best form of getting vitamin D as a supplement. And it should always be taken with some food that has a little fat in it, like some peanut butter or olive oil
or something of that sort.
It enhances the absorption. Uh-huh. Okay. The potential negative side effects of vitamin D in excess are primarily going to be in the issues of raising the blood calcium too much, causing what's called hypercalcemia. And there are certain underlying conditions if people have certain cancers that tend to be cause high calcium, or they have a condition called sarcoidosis, which can cause high calcium. If they're taking large amounts of calcium supplementation already, too much vitamin D can be bad for you.
Yeah. Hey, listen, Maria, I know you have other questions, but I'm trying to get to everybody, and there's a long line behind you.
Could I just finish this? It's vitamin E. I mean, I was told by my doctor that vitamin E could cause gas. So that's why I asked about vitamin D. I mean, I don't have any serious problems. So
yeah,
I'm wondering.
No, I've really not had issues of vitamin D causing gas in patients.
Yeah. Thanks, Maria.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Jack in Wilbraham. Jack, you're on.
Hi. Hello?
Hello. Are you there?
Hi. Sorry, I was waiting so long. Quick question, a couple questions for you. They're all kind of related. A while back, 5 years ago, you were talking about testosterone, so this triggered the question. I have a testicle that had dropped. I'm in my mid-40s. I noticed it or had it checked out. In my 30s, ultrasound indicated that I had cysts. It still gives me a low-level throbbing pain. There's three parts of my question. First, what are the risks of cancer? Second, how does it affect testosterone? And third, is there anything I can take medically to remove cysts if that's what the problem is?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. As far as anything medically to eliminate or shrink or remove cysts, nothing that I'm aware of. As far as cysts being related to testicular cancer, I mean, I expect that you've been to a good urologist and you've had this evaluated and you've had your scrotum examined. And you've probably had an ultrasound of your testicles to see, you know, that there's nothing solid in the testicle that's a potential tumor, that it's only cysts outside of the testicle. That being said, cysts around the testicle can either come from the surface of the testicle or it can occur in the spermatic tubes that leave the testicle, the vas deferens and the spermatic cord, you know, that then empty in through the prostate into the bladder. And so cysts can occur along in those structures as well. And they tend to always be benign if they're cystic. It's very rare that there's a cyst associated with a tumor. So that tends not to be a big issue at all.
Okay. And what about testosterone levels?
No, it really shouldn't be an issue. The small cysts, certainly there is something called a varicocele, which isn't truly a cyst. A varicocele is a clump of veins that occurs. Okay, it's like varicose veins of the testicle, and when a varicocele occurs, the warm blood decreases the production of testosterone by the testicle. Hmm. Okay, so it can be an issue in fertility. Often, young men who want to father children, if they have a varicocele, need to have the varicocele ligated, and so it shrinks. So the testicles, and there's a reason why the testicles hang outside of the body. You know, our bodies were expertly designed, made, created, or evolved, however you want to look at it. And the testicles as glands need to be in a cooler temperature than the core body temperature, a few degrees cooler, for them to work optimally and to make testosterone.
Interesting. And Jack mentioned a dropped testicle. For the rest of us, what's that?
Well, sometimes what happens, and it's usually an issue of childhood, where a testicle doesn't descend. It stays high up in the inguinal canal.
Right.
And occasionally it has to be surgically pulled down. Sometimes it will go down by itself. Okay. And sometimes if they can't go down at all, actually often it's removed because there's a higher risk of testicular cancer of a non-descended testicle that stays up in the body.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Right. Let's go to Eric in Saratoga. Eric, you're on.
Oh, yes, gentlemen. My question is on, and I heard you mention the CoQ10 for fibromyalgia. I've been with it for 3 years now, but I've noticed it's been symptomatically progressing rapidly, especially like if I injure myself, I'll go through. It may not be immediately, but the pain is excruciating for quite a while after that. And I'm just trying to see, is there, other than the CoQ10, an idea of what to do? You know, I mean, it could be something as bumping my knee and, you know, it all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. And is it my understanding you have underlying fibromyalgia?
I do, yes. And I am on a maintenance of an SSRI, which has been great. And I won't say asymptomatic, but it was bearable and livable with tertiary pain meds. But, you know, other than taking, you know, some heavy narcotics, which I do have availability of, but it's not something I want to do.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a frustrating thing.
Yeah, it's a very complex question you ask, because fibromyalgia can be, a very disabling disorder.
Especially being a male.
Yes, it's unusual in men, more usual in women, but nevertheless, it can be quite disabling. Just very briefly, my take on fibromyalgia is, number one, as I emphasize, that my patients follow excellent nutrition. They try to get some low-level, gentle physical activity on a regular basis, be it stretching, walking.
Yeah, I do yoga.
You know, yoga, Tai Chi. Yep. That they avail themselves of taking wonderful old-fashioned warm Epsom salt baths every night or every other night, which I find very helpful, to make sure they're taking an adequate amount of a simple multiple vitamin, but with additional magnesium to help relax the muscles, that the thyroid levels are checked to make sure there. Sometimes hypothyroidism can aggravate fibromyalgia and mimic fibromyalgia, actually. I've had several patients who thought they had fibromyalgia, but they actually had hypothyroidism.
Right. I get that every 3 months. I have my serum level done, just mm-hmm. my TSH and the free T4,
good.
That purpose.
Well, it sounds like you're being well managed then. And as far as anything,
on how to break the pain cycle when it does happen.
It's difficult. Other, you know, safe things to do are things like acupuncture, healing touch, massage therapy. You know, these are safe, non-drug things to do to help break the pain cycle.
Okay, Jack, Eric, we got to take a break. Thanks a lot. Okay. Listen, folks, the telephone number, there are four free phones, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back with the lightning round in just a few seconds. Here we go.
Support comes from Nathan Latour Hospital, Gloversville, New York, less than 50 minutes from the Capital District, offering minimally invasive procedures for back pain with Dr. Jaan Shen, NLH.org. Capital Roots, formerly Capital District Community Gardens, announcing their new home at the Urban Grow Center. Grow, educate, provide, CapitalRoots.org. Middletown Medical's Pediatric Express, walk-in urgent care for children in Chester, with a pediatrician available weeknights until 9 p.m. MiddletownMedical.com. And Epic 18 Vermont Artisans, Manchester Center, an artisan-owned and operated cooperative craft gallery honoring handmade traditions and contemporary design, EPOCHVermont.com.
Well, all five phones are ringing, folks, and that's great. Doctor, I want to give you, Dr. Jeff Perkins, I want to give you a question. Here's a question. Given that fast food is so much more common today than 40 years ago, have you noticed an effect upon the general health of people in your practice? How often do you recommend we eat fast food, or should we keep eating it at all?
I love that question. Who sent that in?
Mark. Yeah.
Mark, thank you. That's a wonderful question. You know, I'm 68 years of age, and I remember very well how we ate when I was 10 years old in 1956. And, you know, the typical American diet at that time was not a low-fat diet. It was not an excessive amount of carbohydrates and gluten products. It was a balanced diet. We had sandwiches. We had roast beef. We had lamb chops. We had butter.
Yeah,
we drank whole milk, you know. And actually, the incidence of obesity in America at that time, you know, in the 1950s, mid-1960s, was actually much less than it is now.
Yeah, but the average age of death was lower.
Yes, but how much lower, you know, was it? It really wasn't all that much lower. And the quality of life was better because you got to eat a steak once in a while.
Yeah.
You know? So I think fast foods they served a certain purpose, you know, as women entered the workplace
yep.
and men are in the workplace, there's less time for a spouse to cook at home, you sure. know, for someone to cook at home. So they do solve that problem of having something quick that you can pick up through the drive-through or stop into the store. The problem is they tend to be very high, most of these foods, very high in salt, in fat, in calories and bad fats and so forth, which put on weight in people. I mean, there's several exceptions. There's some kinds of fast food, like my wife and I, and I'm not plugging anything, but we go to Boston Market once in a while because we can get a healthy chicken dinner with vegetables, and I feel like it's a reasonably choice versus going to a burger place, a fast food burger place. So I think it's been bad for the American public that we've become so dependent on fast foods, and because I think it's created more diabetes, more hypertension, you know, more obesity, and all the subsequent problems which come down the pike from that.
So let's go to Laura in Marlboro. Okay, Laura, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question. There's a book out that's very popular now called The Wheat Belly, and his point of view is that the wheat we used to eat, like in the 40s or 50s earlier, was Einhorn wheat, and the wheat we're eating now is dwarf wheat, and it's been so genetically modified along the way and changed, and there's been so many variations in wheat along the way, that wheat is actually undigestible, and it's making everyone obese. Your body can't digest it, it can't absorb it. And I'm not talking about white bread. I'm talking about even organic, you know, multigrain bread, like no wheat. And he's the person who wrote the book. I don't recall his name in the moment, but he's a doctor, and he had a lot of patients who had colon problems, and he took them all off of wheat, and they all got better. So I was wondering if you've done any work on wheat and whether or not we should eat it. And even if you're not gluten intolerant, you know, is it okay to eat wheat? So that's my question.
Okay.
Well, Jeff? You know, Laura, I will tell you, the number one book I recommend to my patients is William Davis's book, Dr. William Davis, Wheat Belly. So there, you know, I am a proponent for the most part of a lower gluten diet.
Talking about.
Yeah, it's the same book. Okay. Yeah, Wheat Belly by William Davis, who's a respected cardiologist from the Midwest. And I've read his book, and I've looked at his research, and I've looked at other research, and he's pretty much on target that when we think we're eating like a healthy lunch by having a whole a wheat bread sandwich with turkey and so forth, the turkey's good, the lettuce and tomato are good, you know, but having so much gluten in our diet may not be as good for us as we think because, again, when I was 10 years old, it was a different type of wheat, genetically much simpler, easier for the body to digest, and less, let's say, allergenic. Now, realistically speaking, there's several groups of patients. There's people who genetically are truly wheat sensitive, whether it's ancient wheat or new wheat. They have celiac disease. Okay, they need to avoid eating gluten, whether it's ancient or new, because they may get sick from it. Then there's a larger group of people who don't have genetic celiac disease, but they seem to be sensitive, not allergic, but they are reactive to wheat in their diet. And when they eat too much of it, it tends to promote, they tend to have trouble losing weight. Their joints ache more. They may have more eczema. You know, they may have more migraines. They may cognitively feel dull. They just don't feel right. And I've had a number of those kinds of patients, people losing weight who have a lot of wheat-based foods in their diet. Like they're eating wheat two or three times a day. They have Wheaties for breakfast, that turkey sandwich on whole wheat for lunch, and then pasta or pizza for dinner. Or they have a chicken, vegetables, and potato salad, and then a couple rolls with the dinner. I try to convince them that it would be worth having less wheat in your diet. And I have them get that book. I will tell you, I've had patients who have lost very easily without feeling hungry, you know, significant amounts of weight, who've gotten off their diabetes medication, who've been able to get off of their cholesterol medicine or take a lower dose, have lower doses of blood pressure medicine, you know, in eating the way we ate when I was 10 years old. Now, there's another book that sort of complements Wheat Belly, written.
It's The Grain Brain.
No, that's not the book I'm talking about. I know about that book, but I'm going to talk about Mark Sisson's book called The Primal Blueprint, which is a very, very interesting book. He's not a physician. My sense is he's a self-taught nutritionist, health coach, exercise person who seems to be reasonably intelligent, writes a very good book, which I agree with many of the things he says, although he's a proponent of I think, too much fat in the diet. But that's an interesting book to read as well.
Laura, got to let you go. A lot of people behind you. Thanks very much.
Appreciate Thank it. Thank you.
Yep. Let's go to Roger in Schenectady. Roger in Schenectady, you're on.
Yes. I have a question about a sarcoidosis.
Yes.
Through biopsy, they've determined that I have a sarcoidosis. And the reason that it came to the, as a possibility was my calcium level had always been a certain level for years. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and every 3 months I get blood work. And then all of a sudden, it shot up.
Mm.
They put me on prednisone. Mm-hmm. It's now gone down to what it had been prior to having a sarcoidosis diagnosis or having the problem of high calcium.
Right.
It's high normal, but it's still at the same level it's been for years.
So, Roger, what's the question?
My question is, how long do you stay on prednisone? Because as a diabetic, it makes you feel crazy.
Yeah, I understand. It's a very good question, Roger. Certainly, prednisone is going to mess up your blood sugars, and they're not going to go lower. They're going to go higher. So you're going to have to take more medicine for your diabetes, you know, to control your sugars.
And what's sarcoidosis?
Sarcoidosis is a disease of unclear cause that it causes what's called a granulomatous. That's a pathology term when you look at a slide of a tissue, either a lymph node or a lung tissue that has sarcoidosis. It's usually a disease of the lymph nodes, the lungs, although other parts of the body can be affected by it. And it is prednisone responsive, steroid responsive.
But prednisones are great drugs, except that in the end they could really do you in.
I know. Well, this is one of the difficult balances of treating patients. There's always the benefit of the drug versus the risk of the drug.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, when I've had patients with sarcoidosis, we've had to treat them with prednisone for up to 2 years. We started out at a higher dose, and then, you know, monitoring their blood work, their chest x-rays, and so forth is gradually, you know, taper them down to a low dose as quickly as possible. So it really varies depending on how much sarcoidosis one has, where is it located, and so forth. But yeah, you have to be prepared for higher blood sugars and deal with it.
Hey, Roger.
However, since my calcium levels, which are the ones that prompted the suspicion of a sarcoidosis, if they're back to the levels that they had been the years prior to a sarcoidosis, is that some sort of evidence saying it's at least been taken care of as much as we can?
Not necessarily. It's partially possibly. I mean, the prednisone will help lower your calcium levels, but it may that doesn't mean the lower calcium levels does not mean that your sarcoidosis is going away.
Okay, Roger, thank you.
Thank you.
And listen, folks, here's the deal. We got four people hanging on the line right now. Jeff, I need to ask you to keep, if we can, to keep these short answers so that we can try to get everybody in. Okay, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, keep your question short.
What's his feelings on these socks containing copper?
I have no knowledge or understanding of that. I can't answer the question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Jim, thanks a lot. Appreciate
you're
it. Okay, and we'll go to Jeff in Kingston. Jeff in Kingston, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm a 72-year-old man, and I've been increasingly troubled by nocturnal leg cramps. I wondered if the doctor has anything to tell me about that.
Sure. The first thing is to visit your doctor and make sure your circulation to your feet, calves, knees, thighs, and so forth is normal. Number two is, what are the causes of nocturnal leg cramps? Again, circulatory issues. If you're taking certain blood pressure medications, particularly diuretics, low potassium, low magnesium, causes of low calcium can contribute to leg cramps. And assuming all those things have been excluded, then it just happens. It's called idiopathic, which means we as doctors are idiots. We don't know what's causing it.
We don't know.
I love that.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, we'll go to Hedvig. Okay, Hedvig and Hudson, go.
Okay, I'm turning off my radio. Quickly. I want to know if the doctor can guide me to any options for acute pain. Now, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm fine. I don't have anything. But, you know, every now and then somebody gets hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I get hurt, I'm chemically sensitive, and I'm unable to use any opiates. It's life-threatening for me. And even the regular NSAIDs, I have a bad reaction to. So I know about acupuncture. It's very costly. It is not the type of insurance I have. And besides, I'm talking about acute situations. So do you have any insights on what someone like me could resort to? As it is, I'm just on my own, and I've had some really bad times.
Yeah, I understand. I'm sorry for that. That sounds tough. Are you sensitive to aspirin?
I can use aspirin up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps me, you know, but I'm talking about acute situations.
I understand.
You know, something
but
really hurt. Like yeah. You gotta,
yeah.
You know?
No, I understand. But it sounds like, you know, you have limitations based on what you're sensitive to or react adversely to. So
yeah, aspirin I can do, but I can't do the other stuff like ibuprofen
okay.
and all that.
All right, here we
so,
go.
So real quick, you know, acute injury, pain, physical treatments, ice first, then possibly heat. Ice the hell out of it. Okay, keep
mm-hmm.
it cold. That makes a big difference. And then after that is basically aspirin. You know, coated aspirin, of course, and not to take too much of it for the fewest, shortest days you can, a period of time you can, to help you deal with your pain.
Okay, Hedvig, thank you very much. And we'll go to Linda in Saratoga. Linda in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi. I just had a question when you talked about gluten, about genetically modified foods. And where is the medical community in all of this, and why isn't there more outrage?
Yeah. I think the majority of the medical community probably doesn't know about genetically modified foods, and therefore there's no outrage because if you don't have knowledge.
How can you not know?
Hey, Linda. You're getting an answer now. None of this business. Go ahead, Jeff.
So, you know, unfortunately, practicing doctors don't know everything. They know what's in their specialty, and they know what they know to try to help their patients as best as possible. And so we do the best we can. As far as genetically modified foods, I think in some cases, particularly with the wheat issue, I mean, it's certainly better to eat, if you're going to eat wheat, you eat wheat that comes from old wheat, if at all possible. The new wheat, the genetically modified gluten, the dwarf wheat, which is, you know, was designed to not have the wheat stem break, because old wheat was 4 foot tall, the amber waves of grain, you know, well, the amber waves of grain would break if it was windy. An 18-inch wheat doesn't break. It also has two cycles a season, and it can grow anywhere like weeds. So actually, genetically modified wheat isn't all bad because it's helped treat impoverished people around the world who would otherwise starve to death because they wouldn't have wheat, you know, to make food with. So I think there, you know, ideally we should all have old non-genetically modified foods, but we also have the issue of starvation and making foods for a population, for people who would have no food to eat. It's better to eat, I think, a genetically modified food, you know, that provides you with calories and nutrition than no food whatsoever.
Okay, Linda, that's got to be
okay.
It.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Right. Let's go to Ellen in Buckland. Okay, Ellen, we're going to, this may be the last call, but you got to make it real fast. Go ahead.
This is fast.
Test?
When you're doing eating fermented food, the sauerkraut, the pickles should be made without vinegar, salt, and water, because lots of sauerkraut on the shelves have vinegar. That's not fermented. Is that right?
You know, I really can't answer that.
Me neither, yeah. Ellen.
I'm sorry.
Maybe
I don't know whether you're right or not.
We'll have somebody on soon. Thank you. Okay, let's go to Carl. Carl, it's got to be real fast.
Very quickly, what scientific evidence is there of an actual connection between gluten, lactose, and the hundreds of problems that people call up with?
Very little.
That's your answer. Carl, thank you. Okay, so that's the end of today's wonderful show with our wonderful Dr. Jeff Perkins, who knows a great deal and knows how to do those things. We're just out of time, and thank you to everybody for calling. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprasin, natural creams designed to address the epidemic of addiction to pain medicine by providing pain relief for the 21st century, Toprasin.com. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Jartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update.